Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the third public panel of this year's IOSCO annual conference. In this panel, we will be talking about emerging markets and regulatory developments in emerging markets today, and as we see, as we expect them for the future. Before I open up the topic, I would like to introduce to you our distinguished panelists. In the order we sit, to my left is Mr. Tu Guangsha, the Vice Mayor of the beautiful city of Shanghai. To his left, in that order, Mr. UK Sinha, my colleague, Chairman of the India's regulator, Securities Commission, and also chairman of the IOSCO Asia-Pacific Regional Committee. To his left is my professor friend, Mr. Li Yang, Vice President of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. To his left is also a fellow regulator, Mr. Carlos Serrano from Mexico. And at the very end, representing the world marketplace, the President of Shanghai Stock Exchange, Mr. Zhang Yun. So please give a big applause to our panelists, and I think it will be a very informative. Ladies and gentlemen, emerging markets. On this panel, we have only emerging markets. But look what we have. We have China, we have India, we have Mexico, and we have Turkey. These are called emerging markets. Especially when you look at the bigger countries sitting next to the left of me, what is called emerging today, and that word will have to be challenged very, very soon, and we are doing it in IOSCO, will be the dominant players in the world financial marketplace of tomorrow. So in terms of regulation, in terms of technology, in terms of innovation, in terms of anything we do regarding the financial marketplace, in emerging markets today will be the structure of tomorrow. So if you do good things today in our economies today, it will be good for the whole world in the future. Therefore, as the balance of economic power is changing in the world today, as emerging economies, we are trying to develop our markets and our legal infrastructure. We have to be very, very wise, and the whole world, the developed economies, the advanced emerging economies, and the less developed economies have to work hand in hand. But the most critical component of this population is the countries you see and similar countries, advanced, emerging or developed in the borderline are very critical. So whatever we hear from our panels today will give you, I hope, a picture of what we can expect as the world's regulatory framework in the years to come. So without further words, since I am the moderator, I am not supposed to speak too much. If, with your permission, Mr. Mayor, let's start with you. The Vice Mayor of the Shanghai Municipal Government, Mr. Tu Guangsha. Would you please talk about Shanghai and tell what you are doing for Shanghai?
谢谢主持人，同时呢，我也今天非常高兴啊，能和我们这几位朋友，能够参加这一场的这个讨论活动，特别是我非常感动的是，在我们这五个人里面，当然包括主持人六个人里面，他们都是市场的监管者，还有是市场的这个研究啊，这个方面的领导，还有呢是交易所的领导，但是呢只有我呢是一个来自于基层的一个基层干部。 所以呢，他们这个让我来先发言，我想足以体现了 他们对来自于基层干部的这种谦让啊，所以呢，我也想就借这个机会向他们表示感谢，同时呢，也愿意啊，抛砖引玉。那么，我想我的谈话的主要内容嘛，也想叫做对号入座，因为在这一场的这个 panel 里边啊，有一个题目是叫国际金融中心的这个建设，所以我也想啊，就对于上海国际金融中心的建设的一个有关情况来这儿做一点介绍。大家知道上海国际金融中心啊，这个特别是这个经过长时间以来，特别是最近这几年，应该说有了这个比较快的发展。特别是呢，在2009年中央政府呢，进一步确定了要在2020年把上海建成这个与我国的经济实力与人民币的国际地位相适应的国际金融中心。另外呢，就在今年的年初国家发改委也发布了上海国际金融中心建设的“十二五”的规划，也提出来要在“十二五”的最后一年，就是在“十二五”结束的时候，要基本确立上海在人民币的交易定价、资产管理这个包括清算方面的这个国际地位人民币的这个中心地位在全球的这个呢要基本要能够确立。那么很多朋友就问我当国家的这样的一个大的战略部署和规划发布了以后就是说只有几年的时间，当然即使到2020年时间也不到10年了，怎么能够保证上海要建基本的这个目标要在按期能够实现所以今天我想专门就这个问题给大家谈一谈我对这个问题的认识。那就是什么呢？就是主要是谈谈金融市场体系的建设与上海国际金融中心建设之间的这样的一个关系。因为大家知道上海国际金融中心建设的核心内容就是金融市场体系，特别是资本市场这个是上海国际金融中心建设的核心内容。那么这样的一个核心内容确定了之后，那么它今后中国的金融市场体系怎么样发展，怎么样改革，怎么样开放，就必然和上海国际金融中心的建设密切相关甚至可以说它就能够基本的决定上海国际金融中心建设的成效那么我在这儿呢，我想在今后几年关于中国的金融市场体系，特别是资本市场因为我们今天来参加这个年会的都是跟资本市场有关的特别是资本市场在今后几年，我想将会有三个非常明显的趋势，这三个明显的趋势将决定了上海国际金融中心建设在今后几年必将加快，同时呢也能够促进上海国际金融中心建设的战略目标能够按计划按规划能够逐步的实现。那么我在这想，在金融市场体系特别是资本市场会有哪个三个方面的显著的趋势呢？我想第一个显著的趋势就是直接融资的加快发展将带来市场规模的新的扩张，在促进金融体系结构完善的同时，也必将进一步增强上海国际金融中心的影响力我们说从市场规模来看，因为大家知道从中国的整个金融下一步金融改革的一个重头戏或者说是一个主要方向，就是要加快直接融资的发展那么直接融资的发展必然就带来上海国际金融中心以市场体系特别是资本市场体系为核心内容的这样的一个市场规模的一个进一步的扩张。那么我们基本上可以看到的 大概在这些方面，以下几个方面，资本市场的规模将会在今后几年会有明显的扩张。第一个就是从各种市场形态来看，比如说在股市的方面，我们认为股市在今后几年必将还会迎来一个发展的重要的时期，特别是随着多层次资本市场体系的建设，除了股票市场各种这个层次的股票市场，当然还有包括股权的这个市场这个呢，我想这个多层次的资本市场，特别是股票市场、股权市场，这个将来呢，今后几年会迎来一个大的发展所以呢，这个从市场、从股市来看股权股票的市场来看，应该是会有一个大的发展。另外一个呢，比如说从债券市场在直接融资里面，债券市场应该说是一个最重要的一个内容，会加快发展。等一会儿呢，可能他们有几位都会谈到债券市场的这个发展的情况。债券市场的发展在规模增长的同时，会呈现一个多样化的发展的态势。当然我也知道最近在债券市场的品种工具方面又会有新的推进，包括特别是私募债私募债所以呢，债券市场的发展会是一个很大数量级的一个增长。在期货市场来看，大家知道比如说商品期货这个上海嘛，应该说在重大的商品期货的发展方面，这几年推出了一系列重要产品。当然我们也在寄希望下一步其他的重要品种，比如说原油期货这个对于国计民生和整个市场的这个影响那么都会产生极大的这个作用，是吧？那另外再比如像金融期货衍生品其他的衍生品市场，是吧？我想这个也会在今后几年也会是一个大发展的一个趋势。为什么？比如说现在正在筹备的准备的国债期货的市场。另外呢，我不知道大家注意到没有，就是随着人民币利率市场的改革，汇率市场的改革，其实汇率的这个改革大家知道，前不久刚刚汇率的人民币这个汇率的波动范围把它扩大了，这个必将带来金融产品和工具的创新，以适应利率汇率市场的改革，需要有资产管理和风险管理这个方面的工具，这个会有一个极大的，我想今后几年也会有一个逐步的一个发展而且一个很好的前景。除了这种等等这些市场的形态会有很大的增量以外，我们觉得比如说在存量方面大家现在知道，比如说在资产证券化方面这些方面，我想对金融资产的一些存量进一步来加快它的证券化的过程，我会也会增加这个市场的整个的规模的一个扩张再另外呢，我们还有除了我刚才说到的以外，还有其他的各类市场的新的市场形态包括各类理财的产品、信托的收益的一些产品、其他的理财的基金的一些产品，我觉得这些方面今后的这些市场形态也会跟它相互的来配套和互动。所以我觉得第一个直接的趋势就是直接融资的发展会带来市场规模的进一步的显著的扩张，这是一个好事情，这个必然对中国的金融体系和结构的完善带来重要的影响，使得中国的金融体系结构的进一步完善对于中国金融体系的这种弹性以及中国金融体系服务实体经济这个方面的作用也会带来明显的支撑。我想这是我想说的第一个趋势就是在数量的规模方面。第二个今后几年一个明显的趋势是市场化的改革的深化将促进市场功能的更加健全，在市场质量和效率提高的同时，也必将使上海金融中心的作用进一步提升就是我们不光看到数量的规模的扩张，我们还要看到市场化的改革也在加快那么将实际上我们也在从国家的一些部署里面 包括全国金融工作会议，特别是最近一行三会的领导，当然包括我们郭树清主席最近的啊推动的一系列资本市场的改革，我们大家看大家会看到这种改革的一个啊几个特征啊。我体会啊，我把这个市场化改革大概可以归纳为三个方面的特征，三大特征。第一个方面的特征呢，就是行政管制的放松和法治监管的完善啊，这个是当时它是相互互动的啊，它会使得金融创新会加快，金融创新会加快啊，这是第一个特征。第二个特征就是微观层面，就是金融服务机构它的公司治理的健全啊，微观层面的这种管理啊，这种机制的不断的完善，也会使得金融机构服务的能力得到提升，这是第二个大的一个特征，改革的特征。第三个特征就是随着我们有些关键性改革的推进，比如说利率市场化和汇率改革的进一步的深化，当然我说为什么说用进一步的深化，其实我们的利率汇率的改革啊一直在推进，但是随着它进一步的推进啊，那么必将拓展新的这个金融市场功能的空间啊，金融市场功能的空间。那么这个以这个三大市场化改革的三大特征作为推动的，它必然带来市场功能的进一步的完善。因为我们过去啊说我们规模很大，但是功能不完善，那么随着市场化改革的推动，那么它必然功能会完善。第一个功能的完善体现在哪里呢？就体现在资源配置的功能啊。那资源配置嘛，就是怎么样使得我们的金融资源资金流到好啊需要发展的产业，流到啊成长性好的企业，流到规范发展啊有成长空间的企业啊，就是流到它最需要流到的地方。这个就需要我们的市场的改革，当然包括我们利率的改革还有其他方面的改革，使得资源配置的功能它会进一步的完善啊，这样呢就提高了金融配置资源的这种有效性。特别是随着我们包括市场的并购的这个功能也会提升，市场的优胜劣汰的这个趋势会进一步的显现，所以我觉得它在配置啊资源方面它的功能会大的提升。金融的配置资源的功能提升了，那么对国家对特别是可持续发展啊，当然这个就是功莫大焉。第二个呢，它的功能完善就体现在它的财富和资产管理以及风险管理的功能会进一步的提升啊，因为我们知道随着金融市场的发展，不光是啊各种市场参与者，还有包括一些新的市场参与者需要在这个市场体系里面来配置它的资产，配置它的财富，是吧？我们也知道嘛，是吧？包括比如说将来机构投资人，特别是像社保其他的各个方面的一些啊投资人啊，都需要在这个里面来配置资源啊，来配置它的这个啊这个财富管理，实现财富管理啊。所以呢，这个的它的管理财富和资产管理的功能会进一步的提升啊，这是它的第二大功能。第三大功能就是金融业服务整体服务经济和产业和社会公众的能力，这样的功能也会得到进一步的提升。所以这个三大功能的这个方面的提升，就使得上海国际金融中心建设的国际金融中心的作用啊，它就有些就更加重要。第三个啊，我抓紧点时间了。第三个呢，明显的趋势就是人民币跨境业务的稳步推进，将推动市场对外开放的进一步扩大，在促进人民币国际化进程的同时，也会极大的促进确立上海金融中心作为人民币全球的人民币中心的在全球的地位的进一步确立啊。大家也知道我们现在推进人民币的跨境使用，当然今后嘛是它的国际化，那么作为本币的国际化过程当中，和市场的开放一定是相互互动的，相辅相成，缺一不可。也就是说只有市场的进一步的开放，才能为人民币的国际使用才能提供更好的服务和支持啊。反过来，人民币的国际化的进程的进一步的深入，也必将会带要求你的市场开放要进一步的扩大。 我们知道人民币作为要今后要成为一个货币，要成为国际货币，它三大功能：计价的功能、交易的功能和储备的功能。但是不管是哪一种功能，它都会对于流动性的管理、保值的管理、风险的管理等等这个方面的需要，都会随着从计价到交易到储备，它的这种要求需求都会不断的来增加。所以呢，这就必须要求人民币我们的市场要加快对外开放啊，加快对外开放。当然在这开放的过程当中，我们应该也要看到开放它的进程，是吧？我们一直在说我们现在市场是开放，是有了一定的开放，但是将来今后在投资人和筹资人的开放的匹配方面，在股票市场和债券市场的对外开放的匹配方面，在现货市场和期货市场开放的匹配方面，我觉得今后会有一个逐步推进的一个过程。更重要的是随着资本项目的完全开放和人民币的可兑换的进程，那么我想这个开放啊，必然市场的开放必然使得市场啊，在全球的这个人民币的这个体系里面啊，应该说扮演非常重要的角色。这样呢，就使得上海国际金融中心作为国际化的程度将得到极大的提升。所以我想有了这个三大趋势，在今后几年的这样的一个逐步的啊加快，这个趋势的不断的这种强化，我想上海国际金融中心，我们有理由说，也有信心说，上海国际金融中心的这个目标是能够实现的。谢谢大家。
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. I don't know if the word mayor is a proper translation, but it's so nice to hear a mayor talk so much finance. Once you are finished with Shanghai, can we transfer you to Istanbul? You see, Shanghai, in the path to becoming an international finance center, is an example which shows what the advanced economies will be in the very near future. Just before I continue, let me make a case for myself from your speech. Now, on the east here, we have Hong Kong and Shanghai soon coming up, Tokyo, Singapore, Seoul, Kuala Lumpur, a number of financial centers on different scales. On the west, you have New York, Chicago, London, Frankfurt. But in the middle, you have nothing. And in my home country, in Turkey, our government is trying to put Istanbul in the middle. So when you travel, you stop by. But we need a mayor like yourself, who speaks so much finance, more than the stock market president. Now we'll be with it. Okay, we started late. So with all my apologies, I will ask the panelists to limit their speeches to within 12 minutes instead of 15 minutes, if possible, so that we have some time for Q&A at the end. Now our next speaker will be Chairman of India's Authority, my friend Mr. Sinha. I think he will give us a broader picture of emerging markets vis-a-vis regulation. Mr. Chairman, you may sit down or either way you... Okay, please. I'm Chairman Sinha, please.
Thank you. I will be talking about the trends in the regulatory domain, especially in the emerging markets, and I'll try to make out a case based on what I understand is going to happen and what is guiding the authorities in their regulatory decisions. I'm conscious of the fact that the theme of this session is focused towards the emerging markets. 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, when we talked of the emerging markets, we always had in our mind that there is something called a developed market, and that perhaps the emerging markets have to catch up to the developed markets. I think the developments in the last 4 or 5 years have proven that there is no standard, there is no role model, and maybe there is something which the emerging markets can also provide to rest of the world. I remember a comment which was made by the chairman of the Chinese Securities Regulation Commission yesterday, and he made a very important point that there is no absolute or fixed standards, and countries have to develop and decide their policies based on their own stage of development. He was talking in the context of convertibility, but I think this statement is valid in the larger context of the entire capital market. Countries are no longer being guided by a particular role model and they will be following it. They would be guided, especially in the emerging markets, by what they think is relevant to them and what is the stage of their development. What it means for us is that we should not expect a very big bang reform in any of the domains. What we should expect is that people or the authorities will start working based on what they think is right and how well prepared that country is. I would like to bring you back to the point that we are dealing with a market, we are talking about a market where there are no guarantees. In the financial sector, you are aware that, for example, in the banking sector, especially for the small investors, there is a guarantee. Here, there is no guarantee. So entire apparatus is dependent upon trust. What people think they can trust the authorities or they can trust the market participants. And what has happened that this element of trust has been shaken. And the regulators all over the world are under pressure from the general public, from their political masters, that what are you doing to restore that trust? And I think whenever we try to analyze what a regulator is doing or going to do, we have to keep this aspect particularly in mind, that whether the trust of the people is being restored or not. I like to highlight this by talking about two terms which are very frequently used in our market. One is liquidity, another one is price discovery. While liquidity and price discovery are absolutely important, but let us also not forget that financial stability and equity are also very, very important. And regulators, the thought process in the regulatory bodies will also be guided by these considerations. We have to see that things are not disruptive. We have to see that all the investors are being treated equally. So a new context or a new meaning has to be given to these terms, because anybody you talk to, the prevailing wisdom is that you try and increase the liquidity and then there will be better price discovery. Liquidity is the panacea of all the requirements, all the ills. Now I think there is a case for looking into also the quality of the liquidity. We have to reach to that stage that what quality of the liquidity we are talking of. I'll give you an example of high frequency trading. And I'd like to give you some developments which have happened in my country, that is India. People are now talking about and worried about that this rapid withdrawal of the algo trading, how is it affecting the markets? The impact of the transitory volatility, how is it affecting the markets? Is there any unfair advantage to certain people? What happens when there is an error in the algo? And I don't want to repeat the instances, but you may be aware that more than one instances have happened where markets have gone for a very, very irrational fall. I'd like to inform you that in India, about a month ago, we have prescribed our directions on how to deal with high frequency and algo trading. Basically, what we have provided for is, number one, we have provided for disincentives for high order to trade ratio. If the order to trade ratio is high, there is a financial disincentive which is now built into the system. We have asked the exchanges to be alert in monitoring the order flooding. For dysfunctional algos, we have prepared the exchanges, and there are now mechanisms that if there is a dysfunctional algo, how it will be disabled and how the margins will be collected. And when the margin goes down, we have provided as a measure of safety that the terminal will not be automatically enabled. It will have to be manually alerted so that people can see that things are all right. And we have provided for a system audit. We have also provided that in case of any investigation, the exchanges will be entitled to see the details of the trading strategy. Not otherwise, but in case of investigation. So these safeguards we have provided, and although this is only about a month old, our feedback is that it has brought about certain amount of sanity in the market. We have not stopped the trading. We want this trading to happen, but in a certain regulated way. I'm giving this example to make the point that what is guiding the regulators when they are dealing with various issues. I'd like to give you another example of the price discovery in the IPOs. I'm aware that some of the fellow regulators, for example, Hong Kong has come out with a draft discussion paper. China has tried to do something about reforms in the IPO process. Again, I would like to give you the example of India. We discovered that over the last 6 months or 1 year period, there were very high volatility. On the upper side, it would go to as high as maybe 150 to 200% and come down to maybe 70% or 80% of the issue price. While the prevailing thinking, not only in India but other parts of the world, was that while the market was good, everybody thought that IPO means you are going to make a gain on the listing day. And nobody was protesting, because by and large this was happening for a reasonable period of time. But when 7 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 issues were trading at a price much below the IPO price and there was heavy volatility, people started protesting, and people also started making allegations of market manipulation. So what we have provided in India, again about 2 months back, we have provided for a pre-open market, pre-market call auction mechanism. So the call auction mechanism, which is a 1 hour window before the market opens, that window has been allowed. In that window, there is no price limit and the price can be discovered. But whatever is the reference price which is discovered in the call auction, that price becomes the reference price for the normal market hours. And all the IPOs that have come about after that, we have found that again, there is subdued volatility in the market because of this. So while on the one hand, the price discovery mechanism has not been affected, there is no artificial price limit, so it can be discovered in the pre-open session, but in the normal session, there will be a price band. And this price band in the normal session was there from before, only on the opening day it was not there. Another thing which we have done is, and I think it has helped, is we have now put some more restrictions or obligations on the investment bankers so far as their due diligence is concerned. So they will have to, according to our instructions, maintain a record of the due diligence that they have done. And that due diligence record will be available after up to 3 years after the issue has been made. I'll give you an example. In one particular case in my country, in the IPO, there was a submission by the investment banker and the promoter that they have a plant and machinery in a particular city. And when the issue finally came out, we received complaints that there was no plant, no machinery. We sent our inspectors, and we found that, yes, the promoter as well as the merchant banker had misled SEBI and misled the general investors. Of course, we took some action, But now we have provided that there has to be a certain amount of due diligence. We have also insisted that in case of IPO, there will be a track record of the investment bankers, which will be also disclosed in a manner that we have prescribed. We have also started regulating the hedge funds. Here also, the main thought is about how to disclose the size of the industry. They will have a registration requirement. They have an obligation to submit reports and returns. So through all these mechanisms, what we have tried is to have a system whereby a certain amount of information sharing is there with the general public, and the regulator has a right to regulate that. I'll come to the example of derivatives. We have a mechanism for derivatives, but I'm rather surprised, and I'm sure all of you would be surprised, that in 2012, a massive incident has happened, where only about a month back, it was complained that this is nothing, this is a tempest in a teacup. But the tempest in the teacup has become more than $2 billion of effort, $2 billion of impact, and I don't know what other institutions are going to be impacted by that. So in case of derivative as well, there is, for example, need to proceed further. I'll make two very small points. One is technology, the use of technology, the way it is changing. We, that means the regulator and the industry, have to worry that can the individual start trading on his own, and can it lead to disintermediation? So how to deal with that situation? And lastly, I would like to highlight that because of these developments, regulators are talking to each other, coordinating with each other, both at the international level and within the domestic level. And the whole idea is to provide a semblance of orderly development of the market, no big bang. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you've touched upon a number of important points, all of which show how difficult is our job as regulators is. We don't want to be standing in the way of innovation, but at the same time, we want a fair and efficient price mechanism. So it's a difficult job. But as the world is expecting an equity gap of more than $10, $11, $12 trillion in about 10 to 12 years, whatever we do in terms of reorganizing our exchanges, rewriting our regulations from now on, especially for equity markets, has become so much more important. That theme has to be very much spoken about. Okay, now I move on with your permission to Professor Li Yang from China Academy of Sciences, from my home world of academia. Professor, please.
尊敬的主持人、女士们、先生们、南硕士，中午好了。这个非常荣幸啊，有这样一个宝贵的机会啊，同大家来交流看法。那么这个短短的15分钟呢，我想就中国未来这个金融改革和发展的一个问题，也就是如何处理好我们的债务问题啊，同大家做些简短的讨论。大家知道，我们一谈改革、谈发展。 总是要有所借鉴，那么借鉴呢，或者是已经发生的经验，或者是呢已经出现了一些教训。值此金融危机正在深化之时，那么我们主要的经验或者教训的来源，那都是金融危机，啊，这是毫无疑问的。而这次危机，我想问题是非常多了，它是一本 大的教科书值得我们去挖掘。那么最重要的教训，那就是金融业不能杠杆率过高，对吧？不能负债，对吧？其实这也是一个老的智慧，对吧？就是说不要杠杆率过高，这是一个老问题。这个以前我们就知道，30年代的危机的时候，当时美国一个经济学家正在危机也在发生的过程中。 他说：“危机啊，不在于过度投资，也不在于过度投机，就在于过度负债。”那么到今天，事情啊还是集中在这里。 那么由于这个问题极端重要，所以呢，在我们就需要研究，如果我们规划中国未来改革和发展的话，就需要研究中国的这个债务的状况。那么我呢，领导一个研究小组，这个做了大概有一年多的研究，很快呢有一份研究成果，这份成果的总的题目呢是中国的国家资产负债表的研究。那么这个月下个月在经济研究会连续两期发表这个主要的成果，那么这个成果呢很快也会给国际货币基金组织啊供他们参考。我在这里呢讲一些与我们这个主题啊相关的一些发现，有三个发现。一个发现呢，就是中国的整个的债务水平啊，处在一个从全球来看呢是中低下，啊，全球的这个平均的水平在200多，也就是说总的债务，这个债务是一个总和，居民债务、企业债务、政府债务加在一起，对 GDP 的一个比重，全世界呢在200这个左右，高的呢美国啊、英国、啊、日本都很高，最高到500多，中国。是168.9，啊，是在低于平均水平，啊，那么应当说呢，这个是我们可以宽慰的，因为现在这个有一些人在唱衰中国，唱衰中国的一个很重要的理由就认为中国啊，这个这段时间里积累了很多的债务，到处是不是能够清偿，债务是不是这个会成坏账。坏账到时候有没有足够的资财去弥合这个坏账，是大家有很多的这个讨论。那么至少我们研究的结果，这个问题不严重，我们处在一种健康的一个范围之内。第二个发现呢，就是中国的杠杆率，就是债务的比率上升的非常的快，这也是一个事实，而且是每发生一次危机，无论这个危机是发生在国际上还是发生在国内，债务就越增一次，啊，最近的三次，一个是亚洲金融危机，一个是在世纪初美国的 IT 泡沫危机，再一个就是这次2007年3月份开始的这次全球的金融危机，每一次危机债务率都上升得非常的快，啊，那么现在还处在这个上升的过程之中。那么如果说这个危机像我们预测的那样，如果还要延续很长时间，那么我们也可以合理的预计中国的债务率还会再上升，啊，我想很多观察者，特别是唱衰中国的观察者，正是观察到现在债务率上升非常快这样一个事实，啊，就我觉得这是事实，但是呢由于总的债务水平不高啊，目前还不太危险。第三个我觉得值得说一说的发现呢，就是尽管整个中国作为一个国家，作为一个总体的债务率不高，但是非常值得关注的是中国企业的债务率是极高的，啊，那么我们说刚才说中国这个总债务率是168.9，其中企业债务率呢是105.4%，是在研究中20几个国家里最高的，都高于美国，高于日本，高于所有我们知道这些是陷入深重危机的国家，对吧？这个问题呢，我们觉得是问题，啊，是问题，因为企业过多的负债，啊，过多的负债。如果经济比较平稳，而且在高增长这样一个这个轨道上继续行走，没有问题。如果出现波动，如果下滑，企业就有还不起债的问题。企业还不清债，企业欠的是谁的债呢？银行的债。银行就有不良资产问题，银行出现不良资产，马上它就会牵涉到我们整个金融体系，牵涉到我们整个国民经济，所以这个问题特别的突出，啊，那么这个国际上有一些研究，就说这个债务啊，也不是说可能高了不好，不是这样，因为金融的功能就是要提高杠杆率嘛，对吧？杠杆这个有个杠杆率存在，使得我们能够更有效的配置资源。但是呢也不是说无限，所以有一个阈值，超过了这个阈值就不好了，对吧？在这个阈值之前呢都还可以。那么在关于企业这个债务率的阈值的研究，通常认为80%是合适的，超过80%就是危险的。中国现在是100几， 已经超过那个危险水平挺多了，这个是我们研究的一个成功，其他还有很多的发现很有意思啊。这个从我觉得这次危机啊，确实让我们换一个角度来看这个问题啊。这个我们看到了我们的长处，也看到了我们的短处。那么解决债务问题，它的最根本途径，从金融改革的角度来说呢，就是要发展资本市场，啊，所以发展资本市场这个问题是我们的一个老话题啊。从这个我们国家把发展资本市场这样一个事情作为一个非常大的事情啊，这一直是排在这个优先次序啊，是排得比较前的。我觉得这次危机接触出的一些就是过度负债而导致的一些问题，使得我们发展资本市场有了更的大的紧迫性，有了更多的理由，啊，所以从这个角度来看呢，这个我们国家我们这个目前这个资本市场的发展呢，我觉得有这样几个问题。一个问题就是我们在这个资本市场上，企业虽然说它这个负债率很高，但是它不在市场上负债，还是在资本在这个银行体系的负债，就是企业对资本市场的运用是不够的，啊，这是它的第一个问题。第二个问题呢，就是中国股票市场市值，对啊，就我们这个它的资本化的价值应当说很高，而且上升的很快。啊，如果我们这个政策再稍微一点，可能上得很快，现在世界名列前茅。但是与它一个非常不相称的一个事实就是，我们的上市公司的数目是很少的。这也表明我们这个股票市场啊，是为贵族企业服务的，不是为一般的企业服务的。我们可以有很大的市值，我们可以有单个市值最大的公司，这几年世界上最大都在我们这里，但是广大的企业没有因股票市场的发展而获得好处，啊，这个是在这个发现也是非常突出的。那么这样的话，于是这个我们所谓发展多层次资本市场，也就是要往草根去发展，要让更多的小这个中等企业、小企业甚至是微型企业通过各种方式接近股票市场，那就是一个非常合理的而且是紧迫的目标，啊，那么在这方面应当说我们还有大量的事情要做。第三个问题呢，就是债券市场的这个整个总量比较低，结构呢比不合理，对吧？总量低就是说我们在债券市场中，债券市场的总价值占我们整个中国的总负债的价值比重在5%以下，也就是说我们整个负债，我们说了这么多，用债券这样一种可流动性比较高、可交易的、这个定价也比较这个公平、比较公开的这个这种形式提供的很少，啊，比重啊非常之低。第二个呢，我们这个在债券市场第二个问题呢，是债券的价值占 GDP 的比重很低，啊，债券。第三个问题呢，就是整个我们的债券中非金融公司的债券占总债券的比重很低，对吧？就是也就是说，说这个我们有时候我记得有一次我们国内开讨论会啊，我说现在债，这个A 银行发 B 银行买 ，C 银行发这个甲这个证券公司买，对吧？这个 A 这个证券公司发这个某保险公司买，都是金融机构自己在自娱自乐，就不为实体经济服务，啊，这是一个很大的问题，啊。第四个问题呢，就是我们政府债券啊，这个比重还是比较大。但是政府债券，一它作为核心这个资本市场核心这个债券市场的作用没有发挥，啊，在世界各国啊，这个政府债券市场都是。第二呢，结构太单一，我们基本上是中期债券为主。没有短债，就是说政府债券没有短债，那么也没有长债，都是中期债务，所以5年7年是吧？这个呢是使得我们这个市场的这个收益率曲线很难那个非常准确的画出来。那么这个债券市场中的第五个问题呢，就是非金融公司债过于分散，就那么一点还分散，那分散还有好多名目 归不同的部门去管。我想这个债券市场是不是有这么些，还有很多问题，我们这个觉得这几个问题啊可能比较突出。那么我们资本市场的第四个问题呢，就是衍生品市场啊相当的不发展。这次危机这个发生，这个是在衍生品市场上这个发端的，但是呢这个我想市场也是非常理性的对待这样一个事实，就是衍生品市场还是要发展的。那么中国的衍生品市场不发展啊，我们觉得体现在三个方面，就是它这个有三个特征吧。第一个呢，就是人民币衍生品市场不发展，啊。第二个呢，就是我们的定价基准没有建立。这个那衍生市场，衍生市场要靠一些这个原生市场这个给予定价，这个基准要从那里来，我们没有，这样我们这个是没有。第三呢，我们市场上现在，大家能够看到的在操作的衍生品基本上是外国公司或者是与外国有关的公司首创的，当然对他们也不是首创，他引进来的，但就是我的意思是说中国的完全本土的金融机构说这个提供的创造的衍生品基本上没有。这第四个，第五个，我们这个市场第五个问题比较封闭，这个我们用了一个指标，就是所谓开放程度。这个开放程度呢，就是就分子呢是外国资产加外国负债减我们持有的这个国外的资产国际储备除以 GDP， 那我们这个比重啊是在 0.5 以下，非常之低，非常之低。那么这也是构成使得我们这个资本市场不发展一个很重要原因。那么显然我列了这么多问题，所有这些问题都是下一步改革的题目，对吧？那么在这个结束我这个简短的讲话之前呢，我想概括一下，我觉得改革呢主要有三个方向。一个方向呢要市场化，对吧？这个是我们都像涂主席啊，我们都参加这个中国这个改革，我们这几十年都一直在这里边参加讨论。一个很大的问题，很多事情该交给市场的我们都拿在政府，而且拿在很高的级别上去决定。你看刚刚说的这个关少这个市长在说什么什么这个期货呀，什么什么什么等等，这都又不是市场决定嘛，有人说要卖，有人说买，买卖这个两情相悦，它就成了。我们把它提高到一个那种高度，维稳的高度去讨论，那就没办法了，所以这产品都推不出来嘛。所以该市场决定由市场决定，该政府决定政府决定。这个我觉得呢，这个我作为一个长期研究我们国家金融体系改革和资本市场发展的人，这个我有这样一个切身的体会，大量的事情交给市场去，对吧？第二呢，就是我们要有监管的协调，对吧？中国现在应当说分部门的监管我们已经达到了国际，不说先进水平，已经是国际的水平，对吧？证券的监管，我们这个银行的监管，我们保险的监管，这个等等啊，这几个就各自领域而言都达到相当的水平，但是不协调，于是呢就整个的效率啊就在下降，对吧？这个下面协调监管的很重要。最后一个，我们需要货币政策要在这个宏观审慎这个层面重新建立我们的货币政策体系，这里面实际上也是协调的问题。好，这个就我就讲这么些，谢谢各位。
Thank you, Professor. I think from your speech, the most important thing I got is that too much debt is call for disaster. Banks borrowing from each other, banks buying each other's bonds, basically a case in what we call systemic risk.But if you don't want the regulators around too much, then if something goes wrong, it's the people who pay the price. So let the regulators be the umbrella before the sun for you, a little bit, not too much. And then maybe the problem with having too much debt is having too much debt. Maybe that should not be allowed one way or the other, because it becomes a social problem at the end of the day, probably. Well,we may try to develop our markets, exchanges, regulations, so on and so forth, but without the proper macroeconomic setting, without proper savings,
all of these things are very difficult. So our next speaker will be Mr. Carlos Serena from Mexico, from the Mexican Authority. Please, Carlos.
Well, thank you. I want to begin by thanking the China Securities Regulatory Commission for hosting this wonderful IOSCO event. It's been quite a pleasure to be here in this fantastic city and sharing thoughts with you in the conference. My talk is going to focus on some key issues that we see from the perspective of emerging markets on how better to foster the development of capital markets. I'm going to focus on three main points. The first one is, what are the challenges that are posed by the recent increase in financial savings that we are seeing in many emerging economies? Second, how to distinguish between supply and demand factors when trying to foster the development of capital markets? And also, on the third on the list, what are the best policies that we have been learning in emerging markets on how to develop corporate bond markets? The first thing I want to say from the perspective of emerging markets is that most emerging markets have shown an important increase in financial savings, at least in the last decade. That's a fact that we have been discussing over the last year. Many of the large emerging economies have increased the saving rates, and not only their saving rates, but the percentage of these savings that are channeled through the financial system. We know in particular the case of China, but this is the case in many other emerging countries. This has been a result mainly of macroeconomic stability that has been achieved in many of the most important emerging markets, of demographic transitions, and of pension reform, in which many of the emerging markets now have fully funded pension schemes, and that have resulted, of course, in an increase in the pool of financial savings. And of course, this higher amount of savings creates very important opportunities because we have more resources to invest in productive uses. But I'm sorry. We have more resources to invest in productive uses, but also I think it presents important challenges for securities regulators. In particular, I see two trends that we have to take care of as a result of this process of increasing financial savings. The first one is what I call retailization of complex products, and the second, possible asset price inflation in domestic instruments. In terms of this retailization, what we have been observing in some emerging economy is that increasing financial savings can create incentives to sell complex financial products to retail investors. What has been happening in many emerging economies is that the pool of financial savings has been increasing, and since there is a natural source of demand for financial assets, there has been a tendency and an incentive to sell complex instruments to retail investors. So I think that one of the key challenges for emerging market regulators in this context is to develop sound conduct of business regulation so that the practices of financial advisory are based on the principles of know your client, know your product, and suitability. Also, regulations need to prevent possible conflict of interest. Why? Because now that we have this very high pool of savings in many emerging markets, there is the possible incentive for financial institutions to create financial assets and sell them through to their retail clients. So this is something that regulations need to take care of. And finally, I think that a key challenge for regulators in emerging markets is how to supervise the way in which structured nodes designed all over the world are sold to retail investors. I think this is of particular importance because new regulations for global banks have been changing the incentives and the business models for some of the very large global banks. And now, in many cases, there are regulations can create incentives for global banks to get rid of some of the risks that they have built in their balance sheets. And one way to do that is to package those risks in structured notes and to sell them all over the world. And in particular, we have seen a trend of these instruments being sold to retail investors in emerging markets. And this is something that can be a source of problem and that I think that we as regulators in emerging markets need to take care of. On the other hand, I think another challenge that we face in emerging markets is the following. This increased amount of financial savings in many occasions have not been matched by an equivalent increase in the supply of domestic financial assets. So as a result, you can have a situation in which you have a very large pool of financial savings chasing a smaller pool of financial assets, and that can result in domestic asset price inflation. We have seen that in some emerging markets. And of course, domestic asset price inflation can eventually turn out into financial bubbles that can have important financial repercussions from macroeconomic point of view and from financial stability and macroprudential point of view. In order to avoid this, I think one of the key challenges for emerging markets in the years to come is one, trying to foster the supply of domestic assets. The emerging markets need to keep on with the pace of financial savings, supplying good quality financial domestic assets in order to use those pools of savings to finance productive uses in domestically. But also I think that it is another important challenge for this is to design a flexible investment regimes so that allow domestic investors to acquire foreign financial assets. This is, I think it's an important macroprudential policy tool because if we are in a situation in which financial savings are much higher than the supply of domestic financial instruments, that can result in financial bubbles. And one way to take pressure out of this situation is to allow local investors to invest in foreign assets. So this that in some emerging markets has been on occasion a policy that has been discouraged, I think that should be reanalyzed again from a macroprudential point of view. I think that this possibility can decrease the chances of observing a crisis coming from the creation of financial bubbles. And another comment that I want to make is the following. We have been discussing here in this table and elsewhere about the importance of fostering and deepening the development of capital markets. We all agree that this is an important goal for emerging economies. What I will say here is that it is before designing policies to foster this development, it is really important to distinguish what is really holding the development of capital markets in emerging economies. Is it supply factors or demand factors? And I think this has to be done first because the type of policies that you need in order to foster these developments can be quite different. And we are seeing that in many emerging markets, what is really holding the development of capital markets are not factors from the demand side. From many years, we have been thinking that what is holding the development of market of capital markets are factors on the demand side, and probably that was the case for many decades. But now, in many countries, as the base of investors has been deepening, particularly because of the development of a deep institutional investor base, we've seen that in many countries, what is really holding the deepening of capital markets are factors on the supply side. Just briefly, possible demand factors in emerging economies are low investor base, low levels of liquidity, bad enforcement of contracts, insufficient demand from institutional investors due to low penetrations of the insurance mutual fund and pension industries, over-restricted investment regimes, and low flow levels that prevent the entry from minority investors. So I think these are some of the key issues on the demand side. But again, there are, in some countries, there are also factors from the supply side. This can be low levels of competition in some segments of the economy. If we have economies that in some of the industries, there are low levels of competition, we will see firms that do not have the necessity to tap capital markets to compete, and that can be, in some cases, the main reason why capital markets are not developing. Also, family-type structures in many of the firms, many of emerging economies have firms that are still controlled by families that are unwilling to lose control. Third, high transaction costs of issuing equity and debt instruments. In many cases, the costs of tapping capital markets in our countries are high because in many cases we have underdeveloped investment banking industry, so the costs, there is little competition on the investment banking industry in emerging markets, so the costs of having an agreement with an investment bank to tap capital markets can be very high and much higher than what we observe in more advanced economies. And finally, a very important factor is the possible crowding out from government debt. This is a very complex challenge because as we have here in this table and this is a challenge for China. In many emerging countries, a big challenge to develop capital markets is to have a very deep government debt market in different tenors so that there is a benchmarking yield against to which corporates can price. So that's a very necessary and fundamental precondition. But on the other hand, if government debt issuances grow very large, then we have the particular risk of crowding out of private debt. So in general, the management of public debt poses important challenges because we need public debt markets in emerging countries that are deep enough so that they can create a reference core, but no so large that they crowd out the possibility of corporates to issue. I think this is going to be one of the important challenges that we will face in the near future. So basically, these are the most important messages that I want to leave here because of time restrictions. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Carlos. I know you had to cut your presentation in half, but that's all the time we have. Obviously, we need macroeconomic forces working in favor of financial markets to have a sustainable development. Okay, now we move to our last but not least speaker, Mr. Zhang Yujun. He has a PhD in law and PhD in economics, so you must be very scared of money. Now you are running an exchange. How can that be? Please.
各位中午好。首先我要感谢我们台上的几位演讲嘉宾，时间都抓得非常紧。本来我以为我可以省略掉不讲了，结果还有20多分钟，所以我也可以从容地再讲讲啊资本市场的一些情况。就在咱们召开这个论坛的一周前，也是在这个同样一个会场，中国资本市场啊召开了一次很重要的会议。这个会议啊是近9年来这个开的一次会，就近9年没有开过的一次会，叫做推动证券公司啊创新发展的大会。资本市场业界的证券公司、基金公司、监管机构、媒体等方方面面参加这个会议，就中国资本市场怎么样推进创新工作，这个提出了很多有益的建议和计划。今天我想继续就这个主题，就中国资本市场的创新问题，谈一点自己的看法，特别是我主要说上海证券交易所的创新。大家知道中国资本市场，今天我们叫新兴论坛，像这个新兴市场论坛，中国资本市场是一个典型意义的新兴市场，只经历了22年的时间。20多年来啊，我们资本市场的每一件事情都和创新紧紧地连在一起，从小到大，从无到有。这个特别是上海交易所的发展，可以讲啊，上交所今年成立22年，22年的发展历史上所做的大量的这个业务发展工作，紧紧的和创新连在一起。在我们这样一个国家设立上交所，就是一个开天辟地的创新。那么在我们的上交所的历史上涉及到的创新，包括制度创新、技术上的创新、产品创新、组织结构创新，内容很多，内容很多。那么今天因为时间关系，我主要想讲我们当前上交所正在进行的创新。我想简单点到，就是我们的制度创新，讲创新的重要性的时候，我想讲到，就是说中国资本市场创新发展是主线，是主题，是我们资本市场发展的灵魂和动力。我举两个例子，是中国资本市场特有的这个情况来讲，我想讲掉一下创新的重要性。创新的一个重要性，大家知道，我们过去有一个叫做股权分置，后来有个股权分置改革。在座的可能有些年轻人不知道什么叫股权分置了，为什么一定要搞股权分置？后来你还搞改革，对不对？你还把它改了。在中国资本市场筹备准备发起设立的时候，社会和政府最大的担心叫国有资产流失，国有的股份不能转让。当时有这么个限定，所以当时的市场创新者，包括咱们在座的涂市长在内啊，都涂市长、李阳教授都参与了中国市场最早期的设计。那么很顺理成章就推出一个说，那好了，国有资产不动，法人股也别动，不流通，只有一种股票能流通，就是卖给社会的。所以我们早期啊，为了推动资本上创新，有一个很重要的制度设计，叫做股权分开。已经不动的继续不动，动的是新动，这个只能是迈向社会的。所以当时为了推动中国资本的发展，我们搞了一个叫股权分置，分开设立。在股权分开设立的情况下，我们资本市场发展了多少？大约是15、16年的历史，快速成长，翻了很多倍，堆了很多企业，一直到1905年，一直到2005年，发展了15年。企业发展以后就慢慢的随着资本市场的快速进程，我们发现啊，还要创新，要把它必须要让非流通股进入流通。所以从2000年前后，就是市场开始富裕， 不流通的不行，所以一定要进入流通市场。所以我们一开始有一个把流通股和非流通股并在一起的进程，这个进程非常的艰难，引用中国一句古话叫做是非经过不知难。所以这个过程，因为当时我们67%的股份是不能流通的，2%以上的股份是不能流通的，不能流通的要转流通，那么市场流通量 大幅度增加。所以改革这个过程用了2年多时间，我们通过市场化的改革，当时涂市长是制度设计者和推进者之一。所以我们的股权分置改革是因为有股权分置这个创新，我们又推出了股权分置改革这样又一个创新。所以我是想说啊，创新的工作它统统同一个国家的历史发展阶段、文化、制度设计背景紧紧连在一起的。这个前天啊，有一个这个闭门会议，讲中国资本市场的改革与发展，我费了9牛2虎之力，终于说清楚了什么叫做股权分置和为什么要股权分置改革这样一个事情。所以我觉得这阐明一个历史，一个很重要的历史是什么？创新，如果我们只是很简单的模仿，很简单的学习，恐怕是不够的，是不够的。我们还有一个制度初期涉及到的，今后也会涉及到要改革的。我们过去股份在发行制度当中只有增量没有存量，为什么？我们担心你逃跑，担心你的这个逃线兑现。所以在制度设计呢，有一个存量是不能动的，只能增量发股票，这在西方也是没有有的。今天我们也在研讨这样一个改革。所以这两个，我举这两个例子想说明是一个什么道理，就是说在一个国家的资本形成与资本市场发展的道路上，没有一个普遍而适宜的模式或真理。所以借用郭主席一句话，就是说没有最好的，只有更好的，这更贴切这个我们国家资本市场发展这个现状的。所以我是想就讲啊，就创新始终是我们国家资本市场发展的动力和源泉，这一点因一个国家的历史、市场背景、文化、制度、机制不同，其发展必然是要走不同的道路。所以我这里面就想第一个问题啊，做这么一个介绍。那么在上交所的历史上，我们做了很多创新，通过这些创新啊，上交所实现了快速的发展。今天这个上交所的股票市场市值已经是排列全球，这个有很多数据，这个比如说我们的市值第六，交易量第三，这个上市公司940家，市值16.5万亿等等这样一些数据。债券市场方面，上交所已经有挂牌了700多只债券，成交超过20万亿，也进入全球前10个这个债券市场的这个排名。基金市场方面，我们有24只基金品种，在2005年推出了上证50之后，现在我们已经成为亚太区第二位的这个ETF 市场等等这样新内容吧。我们还这个推动技术创新，这个2009年啊，我们通过多年的这个研发啊，推出了新一代交易系统，等等这样一些内容。包括交易系统，其实也是我们国家的特点，和西方是不同的。我们是一个以散户为核心的一个市场，所以交易系统很重要的是说你能容纳多大的交易量。所以现在我们的交易所的这个成交量啊，每秒钟可以撮合10万笔以上。现在我们上交所历史上最高的成交3700亿人民币的成交，我们系统能承担多少呢？2万亿成交，就是这个是不同于西方市场的。交易笔数每天最多的时候交易能交易多少笔数？3000万笔，现在每天1000多万笔。所以这个系统设计也需要接受本国投资人的特点来加以设计。西方的交易所它成交笔数是很低的，不到上交所1/10，因为我们每一笔交易量太小，散户市场，所以这个创新是不同的。那么创新大会之后，按照这个 中国资本市场发展的要求就是更好服务实体经济，更好保护投资人，更好调整产业升级，这样三个更好，这样一个基本要求吧。这个我们上交所啊，继续在过去20多年推动创新发展的基础上，继续将发展作为上交所的一个基本主题。我们这个近期啊，这个在中国资本上同仁这个创新精神和动力的这种鼓舞下，我们在准备做5件事情推动我们的创新工作。这5件事情，第一就是我们讲要推动交易所的服务创新，就是提高服务实体经济、服务国民经济的能力。这个过去10年，从2000年到2010年，过去10年，上交所最重要的使命跟国家服务实体经济啊，完成了2件事情。其中涂市长当时是上交所的前任总经理了，就是我们过去10年完成了2件事情。第一是推动中国的央企上市，中国完成了80多家央企的上市，央企的资产的85%以上在这个是实现了上市工作。所以为什么上交所市值有16.5万亿，成为世界主要交易所按市值排名的一个主要交易所，就是因为一是完成央企上市，第二完成14家大型银行的上市工作。那么今天上交所的发展面临一个重要的转型，就是更好的服务中国的国民经济的发展，就是要提升服务能力。服务的对象按照刚才李阳教授讲的太少，中国上市公司就你那几十家那么大的，那么小的怎么办？所以我们上交所面临重要转型，向服务中型企业乃至小型企业发展。所以在服务上，这个我们拓展服务的渠道、服务的广度、深度，提升服务的质量。所以我们现在服务对象包括上市公司、以上市公司，这是上交所的这个某种意义上讲，这个是我们首要对象、服务对象。这个服务于国民经济的战略性结构调整。所以我们要上交所除了继续吸收还未上市的央企啊、金融企业上市之外，很重要的我们要吸收调整上市结构，吸收来自现代服务业的、来自于新兴产业特别是科技型企业的、来自于文化创意类的、来自于民生产业比如说农业食品企业的上市，调整上市公司结构，加快上市公司的这个服务进程。过去上交所每年大概有这个10几20家企业大型企业上市，现在我们提出了每年至少要有这个几十家、50-60家以上大这个中型企业上市，这样一个基本进程。所以这是一个我们服务的首要目标。第二个，我们服务对象要服务于行业的发展，服务于行业发展，服务于证券公司、基金公司的发展，要为他们提供更多的交易产品，要可提供更多的交易渠道、交易方式、交易机制。所以这一块的话，我们力度很大，力度很大。第三个，我们要服务于投资人，服务于中国的中小投资人。上交所的开户数超过了1亿投资人的账户，每天参与有股票的交易账户有3000多万人，可能超过世界上任何一个交易所投资者的开户数量，包括这个我们和深交所的情况类似的，超过世界上其他交易所开户数量。同时每天参与股票交易的是1000万人左右，这是一个庞大的群体，他们需要信息，他们需要更多的咨询情况，他们需要更好的风险揭示，这样一些内容。所以投资人服务是很重要的。然后我们还要加强对地方政府监管机构的服务，包括这个新闻媒体的服务等等，这样一些内容。所以我们现在同各地政府签署一些合作备忘录，帮地方政府培训企业，为地方政府发展资本市场提供咨询，为整个行业提供资本市场发展的研究咨询，加强各地区各机构之间的沟通等等，这样一些内容。所以上交所啊，服务市场是我们的首要战略， 基本战略，就是提升服务啊国民经济的能力，所以我们把服务创新作为我们的一个最基本的出发点，目标是说鼓励更多的企业能够进入资本市场，能够提高上交所服务资本市场的覆盖面，这服务的这个深度和广度进一步拓展。第二个服务创新还是很重要的内容，我们就是要大力推动更多的金融产品的创新进入资本市场。这一块产品创新包括三个基本内容，就产品创新，首先是基础性产品，刚才这个李阳教授讲了，资本上结构性的毛病很多，总量很大，但毛病还很多，结构性产品，所以我们这块这个基础性产品还要继续扩大。你比如说股票，中小型企业要继续增加，债券我们正在抓紧推这个公司债和高收益债券。公司债的话，这个上交所已经这个有很多公司债上市，但是对小型企业，特别中小微企业的私募债，我们今年啊按照监管机构的要求正在抓紧部署，已经完成了规则的制定、产品设计、行业动员、地方政府沟通等诸多工作，现在是这个闲在箭上，我们是要争取上半年啊把这个推出来。第二类产品创新，我们是推大量的结构化产品为行业服务，就是这个现在大家知道，随着中国居民财富的增长，大家理财的需求、财富管理的需求很多，今年我们规划了十二类产品为这个证券公司、基金公司以及其他机构投资人服务，包括比如说大宗交易、融资融券、这个理财计划、股票回购啊，这个股票抵押融资、分解资产管理计划、交易型资产管理转让计划等等，就是这个等内容，还包括各种基金的产品，这个债券的产品，债券比如说回购协议、一对一式回购、这个瑞子推出、黄金 ETF 等等，这样一些产品，就结构化的产品，这是我们在认真推的。第三类我们在推的就是要继续这个准备推出啊衍生产品，这块我们刚才李阳教授讲的中国衍生产品特别小，确实是这样，我们还要进一步推进衍生产品。上交所我们致力推出个股的期货期权计划，这块我们中国发展衍生品的一个重要障碍是缺乏一批真正的活格投资人，所以我们从培养投资者出发，我们做了一个封闭系统来这个培养投资人，使投资人做到私有，第一他有知识，第二个经历过我们的这个有经验，第三个有风险意识，第四个有培训，第五个还得有财产一定的实力，是这样一些投资人啊能够这个培养更多的能够真正利用衍生品市场的投资人，是我们发展衍生品市场的基础和起点，所以这个工作还要认真做好，这是第二项创新工作。第三项创新工作我们要大力推进的就是交易所，是我们这个英文叫做 SRO 组织，致力监管组织，大力推动监管创新，加强法治建设啊，这个完善上交所自身的治理监管体系。上交所监管包括说公司信息披露监管、会员的准入、二级市场监管等等。近期我们监管啊，这个创新主要放在三个方面。第一是大家都知道的，严防炒新，打击啊炒新股、小股、差股票的这样一个行为。大家知道，我们资本市场资源的配置在效率、有效性上还有很大的改进空间。昨天下午郭主席有一个演讲，其中讲到我们现在股票市盈率最高的50倍以上是差企业，35倍到40倍是小企业，蓝筹股只有12倍左右的市盈率。所以这样这个防止炒新、炒差、炒小，还是这个上交所我们近期监管工作的一个 一个重点。第二项，我们要加强对中介机构的监管，特别是对会计师事务所监管。这工作啊，这个还是十分重要的。第三个，我们要进一步加强证券执法和稽查，这个稽查工作，特别对公司治理当中的围绕公司治理当中的这个违法违规行为啊，要加强治理，使中国的上市公司更真实透明，所以这是一个很重要的工作。这个第三项工作我不展开讲了。第四项是进一步推动技术上创新，完善资本市场发展的各项基础制度设施。这个内容啊，这个十分重要。这个上交所，我们的新系统刚刚上线两年，我们要进一步实现啊新系统的发展能量，进一步啊把这个上交所的新系统运用好。同时，我们正在推进和筹划啊行业的这个技术研发中心，这个设在我们上交所，行业的摘币中心，行业的这个托管服务中心，这个行业的研究发展中心，我们在就是为进一步行业的发展啊，这个做工作，同时提高整个系统的安全效率，提高系统的安全效率。这第四个工作我也不展开讲。第五个是大力推动上交所自身的组织创新。
If you could wrap up, because we are running out of time, please.
第五个，大力推动这个交易所作为自身组织的创新。要知道，上交所我们以市场化、专业化为基本的方向，我们还是个会员制的。上交所正抓紧研究推进自身的公司化改革，抓紧研究推进公司化改革。我们希望能够啊，适应国家市场发展和经济发展的要求，转成一个真正的符合市场经济特点的运行的企业，成为一个这个率先能在自身改革上这个迈出新的步伐。那么由于时间关系啊，我想就讲这些内容。那么刚才图上讲到，要努力把上海打造成这个中国的国际金融中心。那么作为中国要素市场当中这个重要的一员，上交所啊将努力通过发展市场、改革自身的管理制度，努力使中国资本市场能够在全球金融的这个市场的发展中啊成为一个主要的融资中心、交易中心、资产配置中心和风险管理中心，为推动中国资本市场从资本市场大国向金融强国转变做出自己应有的努力。我讲这些，谢谢大家。
Thank you. Somebody sent me a note from the back that there are no suitable questions. I don't know what this means, but I don't know who even sent the note. Anyway, we are out of time and some of us have to catch the plane. No time is left for question and answers. I hope the panel was very informative. Each distinguished speaker gave, I think, very valuable information. And now, if you put together all the presentations, all the information given to you, you know how the world looks like now, basically, from an emerging markets perspective. So I thank everyone and have a good afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Archeray. Ladies and gentlemen, we've had such food for thought in today's panels. Now please join us to enjoy some real food at the lunch buffet in Ballroom C. If you are facing the big screens